Hi, this is Ken McCarthy from Jazz on the Tube, and we've got a really interesting guest today. I've been looking forward to this call for many, many days. His name is James Catchpole. Is that the right way to pronounce it, James?
That's right, yes, Catchpole.
Great. And some of you, I hope, have heard my interview with his partner, work partner, Philip Arneal, about Tokyo Jazz Joints. Is that it?
Yeah, that's right. That's the name of the photo project is Tokyo Jazz Joints.
So we covered that in pretty good detail in the last call with Philip. So I hope everybody, if you haven't heard it, check it out. It is, I just find this really fascinating stuff. But James and I are going to talk about the broader Japanese jazz scene, and we're going to use as a point of departure his website, Tokyo Jazz Site.
That's right, TokyoJazzSite.com. Yep.
Very, very good, generic, straightforward name. You know, easy to remember, TokyoJazzSite.com. And, you know, it occurred to me today, and I'd never given this any thought before, but many, if not all people who become jazz fans at some point in their lives have discovered or stumbled upon a jazz scene, okay? In other words, you can learn a lot about jazz and develop a lot of appreciation of jazz from good radio and good records and CDs, of course. But it's when you find a scene, you know, a club or complex of clubs that, you know, where you can go and hear live music and meet with other fans and just sort of, you know, get into the, and that word scene, I think, is really apt. And I was lucky, I think James was too. I grew up in New York City. I caught the tail end of the lost jazz scene of the 1970s, and that was a time when, believe it or not, young folk, this is really true, it really happened, jazz musicians could have lost in Soho, and a lot of them had their own lofts. Ornette had one, Rashid Ali had one, Oludara had one. I mean, just a lot of people were living in lofts, and they would have concerts in their homes. And it was a great thing, and in those days there was the clubs that no longer exist. There was Fat Tuesdays, which was an amazing place, and Sweet Basil's, which may or may not be around. I don't think it's around anymore. And then the Tin Palace, which was definitely not a palace. It did have a tin roof, where I actually saw George Coleman. The great, you know, this is a small club, and I saw the great George Coleman playing there one night. And so it was a scene. And then the Public Theater of New York had a jazz series that was just stellar. This would have been, oh, I don't know, this was 79 or something. So I went from being a guy that listened to records to a guy that was, you know, in a scene. And it just expanded my knowledge and my appreciation of the music a thousandfold. Then I had the great good fortune to finally wake up and visit New Orleans. And that is another scene, if ever there was one. And I ended up spending many winters down there after the Katrina. And it just expanded my love of the music. So imagine my excitement when I met Philip and discovered James's work too, that there is a whole vast jazz scene in Tokyo. You know, I knew that there's a lot of jazz fans in Japan, but I had no idea what the infrastructure was, what the scene was. And from talking with Philip, and that's something we're going to talk with James, we're going to find out about it. It sounds to me, James, like Tokyo is one of the great jazz hotspots of the planet.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, like you mentioned, you know, a lot of people, a lot of jazz fans around the world, they know that the fans are here. You know, there's a real loyal audience for visiting musicians. It's been a stopping point, pretty much the only stopping point in Asia for many decades for foreign musicians. But people were really unaware of how extensive the local scene is and what that entails, not just the bigger clubs and the concert halls, but all of the kind of small neighborhood places that I've been working on profiling. I certainly never knew that it existed when I first came to Japan. I was shocked. And I've had people visiting from, you know, musicians and friends and acquaintances who've come from all around the world. And I've taken them on, you know, some walks and some bar hopping, and they were just amazed that this whole culture existed. I think it's, you know, there's a lot of Japan and of Japanese culture that's been presented to the world over the decades, and people are very familiar with things like the traditional art forms here. But I think that this somehow slipped through the cracks, and people are unaware that yes, Tokyo and Japan as a country is one of the great jazz locations in the world.
Wow. Let's talk about how you got to Japan, and you live there now. Now, you're originally from Brooklyn?
Yeah. I was born and raised in Brooklyn. And
what neighborhood, if I may ask?
I'm from Midwood.
Oh, wow, the great Midwood, which is, by the way, is one of the great secret neighborhoods of New York. Right now, I don't know what it was like when you grew up, but there's a lot of Eastern European people living there.
I don't think it was as hip and popular when I was growing up as it is now. But no, it was a good neighborhood. It was quite one of the kind of New York neighborhoods that wasn't necessarily of just one ethnicity. It was quite mixed. And yeah, I mean, it was a good place. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, when you grow up in a neighborhood like that in New York City and you're surrounded by so many different types of people, you get exposed to a lot of the different cultures and also, in my case, as a music fan, I mean, a lot of different types of music. So that was a big part of it for me, you know, wanting to get out there and explore different music scenes, you know, was growing up around people who were listening to, you know, I could go to my Puerto Rican friend's house and they're playing salsa, you know, I'd go to a Pakistani friend's house and they were playing, you know, Bollywood pop songs or whatever. So that was kind of like, for me, one of the starts of opening my ears up a bit.
Gotcha. And by the way, that for listeners, that's reflected in James's podcast, which we're going to talk about at some point, I hope, during the call. It's must listening. James, I love your show.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, it is so interesting. Really choice jazz cuts, really choice roots music, and then really choice music from places around the world, and all put together in a really delightful way. It's something we have to definitely talk about. So great. So you had that sort of world music background just by growing up and having your ears open in your own neighborhood.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, when I came to Japan, I first came here a little bit after I graduated from college. I first got here in 1997. And, you know, at that time, you know, obviously pre-smartphone days, you know, you not speaking the language, wandering around the city, it was impossible to find places. And I was already a jazz fan, but I had no idea that they had that kind of community here. And it was only several years later when I had left Japan for a couple of years, went to grad school. And when I came back, I was here as a student for 2 years, a scholarship student, and I had a lot of free time. And rather than doing what I was supposed to be doing, studying and preparing to present papers, I spent my afternoons in a jazz cafe near my university, near Waseda University in Tokyo. There's two or three jazz cafes. And this was the first time I had been in a place like this. And a jazz cafe is a very different environment to what we may think of it as being like in the States. A Japanese jazz cafe is open from, you know, maybe around 11 or 12, opens through to the nighttime. And you go there primarily to listen. You go in and whoever the owner is will have a collection. Sometimes it's really broad. Sometimes they're very specific in what type of genre they like. But the primary reason to go there is it's not for the tasty coffee or rather bland food, but it's because of the owner's incredible library of jazz records. And I mean records, all vinyl most of the time. So I had found a couple places like that while I was supposed to be studying, and I would just hang out there during the day. And then one thing led to another, and you start talking to, you know, some of the owners, some of the regular customers, and they'd say, well, if you like here, go check out this one at a different station nearby. And I was quite naive about it then. I was like, oh, what, you mean there's another place that's like this? my regular local one, which was called Milestones, an old cafe about maybe 40 years old or so. And they said, oh, yeah, there's lots of places like this. And so I started, you know, having a lot of free time. I started wandering around during the days, looking for these cafes, and then in the evening looking for jazz bars. So, you know, I started keeping notes, you know, where did I go, what was it like, who did I talk to, and this was just a fun diversion, a fun hobby. And eventually somebody, a friend of mine, said, you know, you should really put this stuff together, make a blog. So, and this would have been 2006, I guess, yeah, 2006, 2007. So we created... He showed me how to create a simple blog using WordPress. It was just, you know, the real kind of old simple blog role. Like, today I went to this jazz joint and I heard these tunes and I drank this. You know, maybe I put up a really poorly taken cell phone picture. one thing led to another. And, you know, I was wandering around looking for places that someone had told me about. And I couldn't find it. And people who've been to Japan, been to Tokyo, know that this is a vast city, which is very, very confusing, with thousands of tiny alleyways, none of which have any names. So you really get lost looking for places. And I thought to myself, gosh, you know, I really need a guidebook in English. And sort of kind of, you know, a light went off. I thought, well, you know, why don't I do that? I mean, this is what I do in my spare time. Why don't I make the guidebook? And, you know, so I changed the blog to be more of a kind of a database, a source for people who wanted to go to similar places. Because, you know, by then I had noticed that online you had people here in Japan, Western people who were documenting all the hundreds of different kinds of ramen shops or Japanese gardens or where to buy the best tea or where to study judo. There were people documenting everything, but there really wasn't anybody doing jazz. So that was sort of the genesis of how it started. And, you know, the site developed over a bit of time, but the main content and main purpose of the site is to present these places, which are spread out all around the city, to present them in English for fans who can't navigate Japanese online or they can't read any of the Japanese jazz magazines, which, you know, which advertise for them.
Gotcha. Gotcha. And it's so interesting that you were in the country for a couple of years before you even discovered one of these places, and then after discovering one, it took a while to realize there's over 100 cafes, right?
Way more than that, actually. Yeah, I mean, it took, you know, Japan can be a tough place if you don't speak the language, because, you know, English levels are pretty low. And once I studied and then I learned to read, I found that there's a magazine called Jazz Hihyo, a Japanese jazz magazine, and they put out a guidebook, you know, I think a little bit before I started this website, maybe 2005, they put out a guidebook of jazz joints all around the country, and it had hundreds and hundreds of them. Now, of course, this was in Japanese, so which by that point I could read, so that was sort of what got me started. But even there, I found that, you know, I had already knew a couple places that were not in the book.
Uh-huh.
And so once I got going on my own using this Japanese guidebook from Jazz Hihyo magazine, and then mostly using word of mouth, because everywhere I went, no matter how small or, you know, dingy the jazz bar or cafe was, either the owners or some of the regular customers there would introduce me to more names, more places. And so even today, my to-go list, places I haven't been to, but I got on the schedule, I mean, I've got at least another 150 to try and check out.
Wow. And is that just Tokyo?
Well, Tokyo, I mean, it's a little hard to explain. I mean, imagine what I call the Tokyo metropolitan area. Okay. So being from New York, you know that we said a tri-state area. So imagine something equivalent to that, which includes both New York City, but all the surrounding towns. Okay.
Gotcha.
So in Tokyo, it's Tokyo, some of the suburbs, and then there's two port cities south of Tokyo, Kawasaki and Yokohama, which is where I live. I live in Yokohama. And to give you an idea of the size, imagine that you had New York, which was Tokyo, and then 25 miles south, you had Chicago, which is Yokohama. That's the kind of size we're looking at here. So,
wow.
You know, you're looking at hundreds and hundreds of square miles and a population of anywhere between 30 and 35 million people.
Wow.
So you can imagine how long it takes to go and crisscross. I mean, there's over 65 different train lines. I think there's upwards of 1,200 train stations. It's just the largest metropolitan area the world's ever seen. And so it takes a lot of time to find some of these small joints that are hidden in the middle of nowhere, especially when, you know, if it's an older owner, they might not be web savvy, so they might not even have a website. It could just be a tiny neighborhood bar that, you know, somebody's mentioned to me. So, yeah, it's definitely, it's taken a lot of time to go around, but, you know, so far I think we've made pretty good progress.
And there's more to go. This is just incredible. You know, I think those of us from New York, we're a little bit, I don't know, we're biased towards the greatness of New York, and we've, you know, it's the Big Apple and all that, but it really sounds like there's more grassroots jazz activity in Tokyo than New York even. I mean,
yeah, it's tough. You know, when you talk to some musicians, I've got musician friends in New York, a couple who have visited here. There's different levels. I mean, I think New York maintains its place at the top in terms of the quality of the musicians. I mean, pretty much everyone around the world that wants to play at the top level with the best musicians is going to go to New York. And that includes a lot of Japanese musicians too. I mean, there's no questioning that. But in terms of sheer numbers, you know, I mean, I haven't lived in New York for a while, but in times I've visited back, I mean, there's some great clubs, but it's fairly concentrated, and it's, you see people making the rounds at the same places. Here, it's so much more vast, and you've got everything from, I mean, you can go to a bar that seats six people and listen to a trio playing in the corner. You can go from that to outdoor festivals where there's, you know, 10,000 in the audience. And then you've got everything in between. So I think in terms of numbers, there's just way more here. And then that also, I mean, doesn't even take into account the most of the places that I go are not necessarily live clubs. It's more just places to listen to records.
It's almost like having, I think all of us have a friend or two or three or more who's got a great collection, who really knows the music. And you'd go over to his house, or if it was college, you'd go to his dorm room, and you'd just sit there and listen to music all day. It sounds like this has been sort of institutionalized in the form of these cafes.
That is exactly what it's like, Ken. That is exactly what it's like. And when I've tried to describe it to people who haven't been to Japan, and then conversely, you know, when you explain it to Japanese people who are shocked that we don't have these kind of cafes, you know, or bars, I'll say to them, I said, well, you know, listen, you know, in the States, you bring people around your house. Like you just said, you've always got that one buddy who's got a really kick-ass collection. And you go and you'll have a couple drinks and you'll hang out at his place for hours, you know. But in Japan, especially in the Tokyo area, I mean, you know, housing is very small. And you just don't bring six, seven people back to your tiny apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you did, you couldn't really kick the volume up on your speakers because, you know, you're going to disturb the neighbors. That's a big thing here because you're packed into a small space. So these kind of cafes functioned as a social access for people to gather in, to listen to the new records, especially when, you know, when the cafe scene started, we're looking at after World War II. And, you know, people couldn't afford to buy imported records. People couldn't afford to buy stereos even. So these cafes sort of grew organically as a place to congregate, to listen to the music, and to sort of take part in the greater art, the kind of developing underground art scene that really blossomed in Tokyo in the 1960s, like it did in other countries. And that kind of culture, I mean, obviously it's changed now as Japan became a very wealthy country and people can listen at home. Now you can listen to your cell phone, but there's still the element of sort of that this is a collective social experience. That it's obviously great to listen to, you know, a Coltrane record at home, but how much better is it to listen on really great speakers and a fantastic sound system in a cafe having a couple of drinks with like-minded people? I think that's what gives it its sort of its special charm, at least it does for me.
Yeah, it's a fantastic cultural form, and I was saying to Phil, I hope it catches on in other parts of the world, because why not? You know, there's a lot of little marginal cafe spaces that, you know, probably would rent really cheap. And, you know, there's jazz fans everywhere, and not every city or every town has a good jazz club to go.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you know, like if you know when you're traveling and you might, whether it's in Europe or in the States, and you get to like a jazz bar, it has some live music and maybe they have some records, and you're like, wow, this place is really hip. I'm really happy I found it. Well, you know, imagine you're in a neighborhood where there's 10 of those places, and that's just one neighborhood, you know. And so if that could exist here, you know, I think that you could, you know, obviously the numbers would not bear it out in terms of the amount of people, but you could, I mean, there's certainly a space for it in New York. Rent is obviously a problem in New York City, but I think that if somebody were to open this kind of Japanese-style jazz cafe where you go, And primarily you're there to listen, or sometimes there's some live events or some, you know, some seminar events or whatever. But I think there's a great market for that. And I don't know why somebody hasn't taken a shot at it.
Well, I think the work that you and Philip are doing by putting these cafes on the map is going to possibly stimulate that, because, you know, you were in Japan. You didn't even know they existed. I'm a pretty serious fan. I had no clue this exists, that I never even imagined such a thing. So the fact that you guys are documenting it on the web, and then I saw the exhibit, and we're all hoping that a book's going to come out someday, not to pressure you or anything, but I think when people see that, it'll put ideas in their head. And one of the things that Philip mentioned is that none of these are on main thoroughfares or even necessarily on that street level. There may be down an alley, there may be on the second floor. And so it's kind of a place, you know, it's sort of what I call marginal space. It's not, you know, rental space at a super premium. On the other hand, people that are fans, once they find out that the place exists, you know, they don't care where it is. You know, they're going to go because they want to hear the great sound system and meet like-minded friends. I have a little office in a town called Kingston, which is...
I know Kingston very well. I went to Bard College right around the corner from there.
Oh, you're kidding. Well, I landed in the Hudson Valley in Tivoli, so, okay, we were...
Yeah.
What year did you graduate from Bard?
I graduated in 95.
95, okay. I missed you by a couple of years, but yeah, I got there in 98. But yeah, just so you know, if you know Uptown Kingston, there's the big old Dutch Reformed Church with the old graveyard and tombstones from, you know, the 16 and early 1700s. And my office overlooks that, and I've been thinking about, you know, maybe I could have, you know, it'd have to be illegal. I couldn't get a liquor license or anything. It would have to be informal, I guess. But there's plenty of music fans in the Hudson Valley, and actually, you know, we've got... Pat Metheny lives in our neck of the woods. Jack DeJohnette lives in our neck of the woods. Foster.
Absolutely. I mean, that region is, you know, and has been for decades, a place where a lot of artistically minded people gather. And, I mean, there is, without a doubt, there's a space available for that, I think. You know, you should do it.
Yeah, I think I might do it as an art piece. That's what I was telling Philip. I said, you know, someone should set up one of these in an art gallery. Set up a jazz cafe in an art gallery, you know, recreated a Tokyo one, and just let people experience it. And I bet once they experience it, it will put the idea in a lot of people's minds. So now, so the mystery of where all these Japanese jazz fans come from, to me, is now kind of answered, because they hang out in their local jazz cafe, they hang out with their buddies, they hear great music every night or the nights they have free to go. And they build their knowledge. And then when a group comes through town, the group's got a built-in fan base thanks to this infrastructure.
That's exactly right. And I mean, you know, what a lot of people don't realize is that, and I didn't realize this either, I think that as Americans especially, we assume that after the war, when Japan was occupied by the U.S. for 7 years, that all of this culture came in. That jazz records came in, that baseball came in, you know, et cetera. And actually, that's not true for both of those things. Both jazz and baseball were in Japan for 20, 25 years before the war, which I don't think most people knew about. I mean, Babe Ruth visited Japan in the late 1930s. And there were I wouldn't say there were cafes. What there used to be in the Ginza neighborhood in Tokyo, which is a very ritzy kind of central part of town now, but in those days, there were swing halls in the 1920s, just, you know, 20s and early 30s, and quite a few of them. And as Japan moved more into militarism, eventually, you know, those were all shut down. But the eldest, probably the first proper jazz cafe, as we know it, and I think Philip might have mentioned this in the podcast with you, was a place called Chigusa, which was opened in the early 1930s. And the legend has it that the owner there, when there was a sweep and, you know, Western culture was considered degenerate and these places were closed down, the story goes that he took his records, his 78s at the time, and he buried them in his garden so the police wouldn't confiscate them. And he waited out the war years and he survived. And then the day that the war ended, he dug up his records and went back to his old shop and opened his cafe again.
Wow.
Now, whether that's true or not, who knows, but that's the legend that's been passed down. But, I mean, it is definitely certain that that cafe has been there since, you know, since predated the war. And what's really nice is that when the owner died, sometime in the late 80s, I think his sister or brother-in-law might have kept it going, but eventually they had to shut it down. And a group of fans of the cafe decided to reopen it just down the street. And keep the same kind of vibe. So even though it's in a different shop now, it's got the same old style to it. And they reopened it. They got money together from fans who were willing to donate. And they took all of his photos and all of the sketches he'd done over the years. They put them up on the walls. And they brought his record collection. And they reopened the place. And it's fantastic. It's a place called Chigusa in Yokohama. And you walk in there, and it's a tiny, small square room. Maybe 15 to 20 seats total. All the seats face these gigantic speakers, And the music is loud in there. There's no, you're not going there to converse with your friends. You're going in there to listen. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful atmosphere. And it was really, for me, you know, having devoted so much of my time and my passion to exploring these places, it was really touching to see that there were fans willing to reopen basically the eldest, you know, the first jazz cafe in Japan, you know, to keep it going, to keep that tradition alive.
Well, the Japanese have, very intelligently, they have respect for the old stuff. You know, they're not ready necessarily to throw things out, even though the city, I hear it, is completely modernized and there's really no traditional architecture left, really. It keeps getting built and rebuilt on that level. But on a cultural level, you know, remembering and cherishing and cultivating the arts of all various kinds. You know, there's
that's definitely true. And I think that, you know, I've talked about this with visiting jazz musicians, visiting jazz journalists, and I've talked about it with locals here, Japanese people in the industry, about why these places have been able to continue and why they are the way they are. Like you go in and some of the owners of these cafes and bars, they have a knowledge of the music, and not just the music, but of the social conditions that were surrounding the development of jazz in the United States, specifically as we moved into the civil rights years of the 60s. And these are people that don't speak English. Okay. And yet they've taken the time to learn about where this music came from and the people who made it. And the fact that this is made by a minority in the United States that was horrendously oppressed for centuries, and how the music comes from those experiences. The people who run these cafes here have learned about that. And that really filled me with respect, because they weren't just enjoying the tunes, which you could do as a fan. It's fine. You don't have to dive into the history, you know, but they had the respect to learn about where it came from, which I think even a lot of Americans sadly don't know. You know, I mean, jazz is America's music, and it's probably our greatest cultural gift to the world. And yet so many people are ignorant of what it is and where it came from. And so to come halfway across the world and to find people who can't even speak English, who learned about the music and have been teaching me about it. I've had cafe and bar owners look at me in astonishment because I didn't know a particular record that they had on their shelf. And they're like, you're American. How can you not know this? And I was like, well, good point, you know?
So they're like the keepers of the flame over there in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think so. And although it's funny because, you know, alongside that great knowledge of the music, the history of the music, and even just the more, you know, the discography type of stuff, but there's still some gaps. I mean, I've had many people, you know, what I've walked into, say what you would call to the average person, a little rundown, dingy corner jazz bar in an alleyway. Okay. That's only going to appeal to a certain type of fan, like, you know, for you or myself. And I walk in there and I'll be thrilled to have found it. I'll be so happy, and I'm talking to the owner and I'll compliment them on their shop. And sometimes they'll express amazement because they'll be, well, why would you like my little dusty 10-seat bar when you're from America? You're from New York City, the best jazz town in the world. And they don't get it. They don't understand that, no, what you've created here, this little tiny world on an alley in some outskirt neighborhood of Tokyo, this doesn't exist in New York. They think it does. They think that, you know, that you can go to 100 different jazz bars in New York, and I'll have to explain to them, no, that's not the case. This only exists in Japan, you know?
Wow. Hey, James, have you ever been to New Orleans?
I have not, unfortunately, and it's on the menu if I can make it there, but no, I've not been.
Phil told me he hadn't been either. New Orleans is really interesting because there's a lot of, but nowhere on the scale of Tokyo, but of course New Orleans is a much smaller city, but there are a lot of neighborhood joints where live music takes place, and it's the same kind of thing. If you're a tourist and you have, you know, a few days and you're going by a guidebook, you're going to miss 90%, 95% of all the good places. So it's a similar thing. And many of these clubs are really run down. I mean,
I've heard that from a guy who works at a radio station in New Orleans that I was hanging out with here in Tokyo. He was telling me about that, you know, 90% of tourists just don't leave the, you know, what's it, Bourbon Street? French Quarter.
Yeah.
And you know, maybe they're intimidated to go out to some of the neighborhoods, but he said that's where you're going to get the real local vibe. And there's still, so you're saying there's really still a lot of joints like that outside the center?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But again, you need somebody. I was lucky. A friend of mine who'd been there 10 years took me on a tour one night, and we went to maybe, seven or eight places in seven or eight different distinct neighborhoods. And
oh, wow,
some of them are just, they're ratty little bars. And yet you've got some, just wonderful musicians. A lot of musicians like to live in New Orleans because it's such a great, there's always a place to play live. It's got a really freewheeling, open attitude towards music. So, if some guys are playing in a club and one of their buddies, is standing in the back, they'll invite him to come up and do a few numbers. Yeah, it's just real loose, real friendly, real great place to develop your chops. And I bring up New Orleans because if there ever were a place that you guys should exhibit your Tokyo Cafe, Jazz Cafe photographs, New Orleans is the place. If anybody's listening who's got a connection, I mentioned to Philip, I've got a friend that's co-owner of a club in New Orleans, and I'll definitely hook you guys up. But if anybody else,
that would be great because I think for me and definitely for Philip as well, if we could bring this project back to the birthplace and say, listen, your culture and what you've created and given to the world really was something for the world. I mean, it's gone to such an alien environment as Japan and been embraced in very quirky and unexpected ways. I think that would be that to me would be the ultimate, to say that, to bring it back home in a sense,
Well, I guarantee that guys in New Orleans have no idea, unless they're a musician and have been over there. But other than that, I can guarantee that even the knowledgeable New Orleans jazz fan, and by the way, that's the other nice thing about that city. You throw a rock and it's going to bounce off 10 serious jazz fans or music fans who have killer collections. So they've never heard about this, and they're going to love to know about it.
Right.
They're going to recognize their own passion reflected back at them from Tokyo. And if ever there is a city where somebody might get the idea of opening the first American Tokyo-style jazz cafe, it's going to be in New Orleans because they just have...
I'm sure. What I hear, it's the kind of place where, people who don't have a problem with drinking and smoking all day, like they do here. So that would be suitable, yeah.
Not at all. I got to say, just a funny story. They have a lot of street action, parades, music parades, funeral parades, club parades. I mean, it's even more than you can imagine. No matter how much people have talked about it, the actual reality is there's more of it than you can imagine. In fact, I would say there's probably as many parades during the course of the year as there are Tokyo jazz cafes. I mean, they're endless. They just, it keeps, you're driving through town, there's another one. Oh my God, it's just, they never end. And they're real loose, and it's, for some reason, it's okay to set up card table and put a bottle of bourbon and a bottle of scotch on it and some Dixie cups and sell shots. How they get away with it, I can't even fathom. But it's that kind of a town. So yeah, we got to get your show
to
New Orleans. It will definitely find friends. So you give tours now. Is this something that you just do informally, or is it turning into a regular thing? Because I'll tell you, if I ever go to Tokyo, you're going to be the first person I'm going to call.
That's great. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it kind of developed a bit casually. After I'd had the website going for a couple years, people would come over, some friends or acquaintances, and be like, hey, take me to some of these places. And while we would walk around, I would, give them a little bit of a chat about the history of Tokyo and how the city developed and this and that. And, a friend of mine was like, you should really do this, on the side. You're a good tour guide, and you're gonna be able to show people places that they would have no chance of finding as a tourist because the city is so huge and confusing. And I said, okay. So I put it on a previous version of the website before I updated earlier this year. I had a section just said, jazz tourists, contact me and we can set up depending on what you want to do. And people would, I had different people looking for different things. Some people who wanted to go to live shows. Some people wanted to just go on a bar hop and drink in the dingiest, hidden joints. Some people wanted more of like a history type walk where we would just stop into a cafe or two. you know, but also like combine some of the Tokyo sightseeing type stuff. And even had people contact me, some record collectors who were just like, listen, just take me to some of the record stores because I can't find them. And, you know, no talking, no tour guiding, just, okay, here you go. Here's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 shops that are in the middle of nowhere. And right. So, you know, everybody had a different thing that they were looking for, but yeah, it was pretty casual. That was when I was living in the center of Tokyo, right near Shinjuku neighborhood, which is one of the main jazz neighborhoods. A couple of years ago, I moved down to Yokohama. So I kind of took some time off from doing the tours, but recently just started again. You know, right now with the Olympics coming in a few years, and also the yen has dropped a little bit, so the dollar is stronger. So you're getting a lot more tourists coming from the States, also from Europe, a lot of Asian tourists as well. So I've been getting some more requests, and yeah, I've started doing it again. So anybody that's going to be in town, sure, you know, pop me an email. I'm happy to set something up with you. Usually keep it real, real casual. Find out what people are looking for, but generally it would be about 3.5 hours where we'll walk around the Shinjuku area. I'll explain the neighborhood to you, and we'll pop into 3 or 4 jazz joints that most likely you'd never find on your own.
Gotcha. And to do that, they would go to tokyojazzsite.com.
That's right. Yeah, tokyojazzsite.com. Just contact me via email. All my details are up there. And I'm happy to work something out, sure.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, because I'm sure people are listening to this thinking, wow, I got to experience this.
And, you know, it's funny because I've had the same reaction from several people. So we'll walk around. Shinjuku is one of the larger areas in Tokyo, but Tokyo is so big that you don't have one downtown. You've got maybe the equivalent of 6 or 7 downtowns. And so we'll walk around Shinjuku, we'll pop into a cafe, then we'll pop into a bar later in the evening. And then I'll point out a couple clubs and I'll say, okay, go back there tomorrow if you want to catch some live music. And inevitably some of the people will be like, wow, this is, you know, this city's amazing to have so many of these, you know, great spots. And I'll be like, you know, this is only one neighborhood. So you can do this in a lot of different neighborhoods, you know. It's not like when you're traveling in other cities and you find, like, you know, that's the night spot area where you got a couple of hit bars or whatever. You know, in Tokyo, it's everywhere. And even when you get out, I mean, some of my favorite places were, you know, I mean, imagine, it's hard to explain the equivalent, but imagine, you know New York very well. Say somebody told you to go down to, I don't know, go down to Canarsie in Brooklyn, okay?
Right.
And you're like, well, we want to go down there. I don't live there. I don't know anyone there. Like, no, there's one of the best jazz bars in the whole city is in that neighborhood. That's what it's like in Tokyo, you know?
Wow. That's so incongruous, right? It's just so, you know, there's no jazz clubs in Canarsie. There's no jazz clubs in Flushing. There's no Fordham Road,
you wouldn't tell tourists to get on the subway from the city, you know, and go out to the outskirts of Brooklyn. They're going to get lost. They're going to get in trouble or whatever. But in Tokyo, some of my favorite places are actually, you know, in neighborhoods that are either slightly residential or just a little bit outside the central. Or even there's one place which I think right now I just redid the profile of it, so you can see it on the front page of my website, tokyojazzsite.com. A place called Pithecanthropus erectus, and Philip and I think that's the first place we went to for the photo project a couple months ago. I mean, this is a place in an industrial neighborhood in the south part of Tokyo that not only would tourists not go to, but I know a lot of Japanese people that have never been to that station. And he would even ask you, why would you go there? It's really run down and, you know, kind of polluted and dingy. And I said, well, you know, that's where some of the best jazz bars are, you know. That place, when I found that, I was over the moon. I mean, this place was as authentic as it gets. A tiny little square room with, you know, posters on the wall from 30 years ago. It hasn't been cleaned probably since it's been opened.
That sounds like New Orleans. I think there are some bars that have never seen sunlight in the 50 years they've been open.
And, you know, and I remember we walked in there, and yeah, there was an old dude drinking, and they do a bottle keep system in Japan, which is something that we don't do. You buy a bottle of whiskey usually, and you put your name on it, and the bartender, the owner, would just put it behind the bar on a counter, and it's got your name on it. And so whenever you come in, all you pay for is the ice or the, you know, the soda you're going to drink with the bottle of whiskey that you purchased. And basically you can keep it there forever. I mean, I've seen bottles on the shelves in some of these bars from 25 years ago, you know?
Wow. Hey, let's talk about the vinyl. I hear there's some, but between the cafes, collections, and the record shops, there's some amazing vinyl in Tokyo.
Vinyl is unbelievable here. You'll have never seen anything like it. I mean, you walk into, well, okay, the record shops are their own thing. I mean, I'm a little out of the loop, but from what I've heard in, you know, record stores in the States, obviously the chains are gone, and even a lot of the independent places moved online to do online dealing now. It will get that way eventually here, I'm sure, but as of now, I mean, you can walk to, like I mentioned, the Shinjuku neighborhood or Shibuya, you've probably got upwards of 60, 70, easily 70 shops all selling vinyl of all genres, not just jazz. And in terms of the collections, another place, and I'll make sure that, you know, before this airs, I'll get it up on the front page so people can see it easier. There's a place, a very famous place in Shibuya among vinyl heads called JBS, Jazz Blues Soul. And this is a small cafe, just a counter and a couple tiny tables, and there's no decorations in there. It's just ceiling to floor vinyl. I think he's got about 13,000 records in the cafe, and the owner, Kobayashi-san, I believe he's got another 6,000 or 7,000 at home. And so you go in there, and it's just, well, what I like to tell people is that these kinds of places are like libraries, okay? You're going in, and you're going to learn about the music, and it's incredible. I mean, you go into JBS, and he just, I think he told me he buys a new record every day on his way to open the shop. And he's been doing that since he's 15 years old. So that's how he's got this crazy collection. But, you know, like you mentioned earlier, you know, you've met collectors in the States or in Europe who have these, but they're in their home. They're never in a commercial establishment. But in Japan, they're almost always in the shop itself. And yeah, all vinyl and not always original. It depends on where you go, which is now closed, unfortunately. The place where I really, really grew up in as a jazz fan was a place called Jazz Pub Misho, also in the Shinjuku neighborhood. And the owner, Misho-san, who's now 83 years old, he was a big fan of hard bop and soul jazz, which he learned about from soldiers, U.S. soldiers, after the war. And he had a collection of about 6,000 records that were all originals, all from the 50s and 60s, only soul jazz and hard bop. And he taught me about that music because there were a lot of people I'd never heard of, people who maybe never made it to CD. Or I remember he was a big fan of Willis Jackson, the tenor sax player, who I had not heard of before. And he's like, how can you not know Willis Jackson? And he pulls out 18 records, 18 original records, you know, of Willis Jackson. And he's like, come on, you got to listen to this. Have another drink. And I was like, okay, that's fine. Yeah, sure. And, you know, that's the kind of vinyl culture that you have here in these places. You know, it's just remarkable. There's nothing else like it.
Beautiful. Yeah, I mean, New York doesn't have that anymore. You know, there's shops, but you're, as you said, the big record stores are gone. Virgin's out of business, and Tower's gone. And
yeah, you know, the biggest Tower Records here is 9 stories tall. You can see it from a mile away. And yeah, you know, people who are tourists are like, wait, that can't be Tower Records, right? Then they go bankrupt. It's like, no, they're huge here still. Yeah.
That's amazing. It's like an alternate universe for jazz fans, right? Tower Records.
Yeah, completely.
First of all, Tower's still in business. And well, now a lot of the vinyl, jazz vinyl is being carried by little shops. A lot of the little shops are springing up. Talking about Kingston, people that don't know Kingston, I think it's population 15,000 or not big. They've got 2 little vinyl shops. And
oh, that's great.
But good stuff that you'd actually want to own, be excited about owning, used, you're looking at $20, $25 bucks now. Like the golden days of, you know, getting amazing albums in the cutout bin for $2 is way long past. So people now value these things, and I have a feeling there's a shortage developing.
I think, you know, that's what I've heard from a couple of friends of mine here who are much more serious collectors than I am of vinyl. They've mentioned that, although I think here, like you mentioned, like $20, $25 bucks, you can probably, you know, the records, vinyl here can be expensive, but I think, you know, say if you paid $30, $40 here, you're probably looking at more than 100, 120, maybe 3 times the markup to sell that back in the States, you know?
For something really choice.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, wow. Well, James, this is just amazing, and I want to strongly, in the most, you know, most emphatic way to everybody listening, you must check out Tokyo Jazz Site, S-I-T-E, TokyoJazzSite.com, and you definitely must check out TokyoJazzJoints.com. Going to open a whole new world of jazz for you. And if for some reason life takes you to to Tokyo, you will be completely hooked up with very advanced knowledge that's possessed by few human beings. However, you've gotten a lot of good media coverage on your work, haven't you, over the last couple of years?
Yeah, recently it's been pretty good. There's been some journalists from overseas have come over. They've been really, you know, fascinated by this kind of, you know, unknown world. And I've also had the chance to work with some documentary filmmakers. There was a crew from Holland 2 years ago. These great dudes from Paris were making a series called Jazzed Out, where they were documenting jazz scene in 5 cities around the world. And I was able to kind of help them a little bit, and, you know, take them around, and that's been great. And now that we started this kind of more serious photo project, Philip and I were hoping that, you know, as you mentioned, we did the exhibition in New Paltz. Unfortunately, I couldn't make that, but we're hoping to set up another one sometime in next year, maybe in San Francisco, which I'll definitely make. If we could do New Orleans, that would be fantastic. And we're going to do it here maybe at the end of this year or beginning of next year. We're kind of up in the air. But, you know, the photo project's an ongoing project. You know, we've been to, I think, 28 places so far. And we've got another 50 or so on our radar to kind of go and document with, you know, proper photos. So, and while we're doing that, that's the Tokyo Jazz Joints photo project. You know, I'm still working on my website, like adding places I haven't been, you know, doing the listings, the weekly listings of live events. And I've added a new feature recently where I'm trying to interview some local musicians once a week. Get them some exposure in English. So, you know, interview them, translate it to English, get that up online so they can get some publicity. And you mentioned, you know, I also do the podcast too, which is just a bit of fun, but that's been going well too. So we've been able to do, you know, a few live events as well, take the OK Jazz Show to some festivals here. And yeah, it's been growing pretty well over the last couple of years. I hope I can keep it going.
I hope so too. You're doing a great service to the jazz world by documenting this for people who are outside of Japan, or I guess outside of this particular scene, because if you're not in it, you would have no clue that this universe of, you know, small listening outposts throughout Tokyo even exists. Well, James, again, for everybody, the site is tokyojazzsite.com, and that's where you're going to get the best guide to the full world of Japanese jazz joints, not just Japanese places, not just the Blue Note and the big clubs, but the whole deep culture, which until now I didn't even know existed. And then if you go to Tokyo Jazz Joints, you're going to see documents, photo documents, and text about these really amazing, I call them shrines to jazz, where people go and worship the music. And
yeah, they are like shrines, you know, and then also you'll be able to kind of, just visually, you'll pick up from Philip's photographs, which are really wonderful, you'll be able to pick up the subtle differences between, oh, that's kind of a cafe-style place, or, oh, this is like a hardcore drinking bar. And, you know, even though there's some subtle differences in the atmosphere between the cafes and bars, you're still going to have that kind of shrine-like feeling you mentioned, where the music takes precedence over everything else. And, I mean, it's just such a thrill to still go to these and find these places, you know. Because for music fans, I mean, you know, it's a new world now, and it's gotten more expensive to go to these big jazz festivals. So the fact that you can just listen to tunes in your neighborhood, I think, is really one of the things that makes it so special here.
Yeah, it keeps the flame alive while they're waiting for the annual festival to roll around or the next big act to come through town. They can be going to their local jazz place and just hanging with their friends and hearing the latest music or hearing great music from someone's collection. So, James, thank you for the time and for your work. Really, both very much appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Ken. I really appreciate it, and we really love your website as well. I mean, that's just a wonderful resource.
Oh, great. Thanks a lot. So we'll be in touch soon.
You bet. Hope to see you in Tokyo soon. Take care.